Hello and welcome to the Parish Podcast. The sermon you're about to hear was delivered at the Parish in Alpharetta, Georgia, and is meant to be heard within the context of our local church community. So if you've never been to the Parish, you're missing a really big piece of the puzzle. We'd love to welcome you to join us anytime, and you can find more information or contact us by visiting our website at parishanglican.org. So, our gospel passage that Patricia just read is the story of Jesus after he resurrected, because we're still in the season of Easter, we're still remembering the resurrection of Jesus. But after he resurrected, he goes and meets the disciples, and he meets them in a really important context. He meets them at work. Okay, I don't know if you've ever thought of that before, but several of the disciples were fishermen by trade. And so when they realize that Jesus is resurrected, but they don't know where he is and they don't know where he's going to show up, they say, well, let's go back to work and let's do what we know how to do. Let's go fish. And so Jesus shows up and he meets them at work, which is really interesting for us. And I think it's an important thing for us to figure out today, because often we can feel as though our work and God and the gospel and everything that we talk about here can be completely disconnected. One of the first things I realized when we had children was how little time I actually get to spend with them. Have you realized that if you have kids yet? Like, I thought somehow in my mind that I was going to get to spend all this time with them and just hours and hours each day. I was going to get to have fun and train them and teach them in the way they should go. And then I realized after work, you get home and you're exhausted and you get maybe an hour or two before they go to bed. And it's like the worst hour or two of the day because they're cranky and tired. And that's what I've got with my kids. And I looked this week, actually, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released this study and said that the average American spends 7.7 hours a day sleeping. Okay, I don't know if that's you or not. That's not me. That's not my household. But 7.7 hours a day sleeping. But the average American spends 8.9 hours a day working. So way more than we spend sleeping, we spend working. And then that leaves us 7.3 hours for everything else that we got to do in life. Everything, like eating, your bathroom breaks, taking care of whatever you got to take care of around the house, little trips here and there. Everything else has to fit into that 7.3 hours. The majority of our time that we're awake on this planet is spent in some form of work, whether you're working in the marketplace, whether you're working as a stay-at-home mom, whatever it is. In fact, if you're a stay-at-home mom, I think the ratios are a little bit different. It probably looks something like this. A stay-at-home mom probably spends about 21 hours a day working and about 2.5 hours sleeping. And it leaves you about a half hour for a bathroom break, if you're lucky, if you're lucky. That doesn't happen a lot of times at our house. Actually, at the 8:30 service, I switched those accidentally and put 21 hours sleeping. Bad news, that's not good. That would not go over well in my house. So whether you're at home raising kids, which is the most difficult job I can imagine, whether you're out in the marketplace, we spend a vast majority of our waking hours at work. And so that's the challenge for me as a pastor and for us as a church, is I get 1 hour with you. We get 1 hour together to remember the story of God. This is why we read the scriptures over and over again. We're reminding ourselves of the story of God. We're reminding ourselves of the truth of what's really going on in the world. And then we walk out that door and we go back into the marketplace or back into our homes or back into whatever sector of the workforce you work in. And everything pulls us away from that reality for many, many hours in the week. That's a difficult challenge for all of us. And so it's easy for us to get to a place where we feel like our work and our spirituality are completely disconnected, and that God and the reality of the gospel has nothing to say with what we're talking about at work, let alone the idea of revelation and the future and God's glorious future. That's what we're talking about in Easter. If you remember 2 weeks ago, we talked about how when Jesus resurrected, he showed us a glimpse of our future. Even just in his body, in his physical body, which was made new and made perfect, there was this little snapshot of what the future is going to be like for us. And we said that our duty, our job now, is to see our present reality in light of God's glorious future. This is what we're called to do with the mindset of people who believe in the resurrection. Resurrection people view our present reality in light of God's glorious future. So the question today is, what does that have to do with our work? How in the world does God's glorious future affect and impact our work? And the place we're going to find that is in the book of Revelation, okay, which is crazy. And I grew up, I don't know what your experience in the past has been with the book of Revelation. If you shudder when you think of it, then you're probably like me. I heard people trying to analyze the book and, you know, put big charts on paper and say that this is this person and this is this person and this beast equals this country. And we can do that. We can go through all that and play that game. But Revelation in and of itself is not something for us to shy away from. It's an incredible book. It's amazing. If you've never read it, you need to go back and read it. It is beautifully written. It's masterfully composed. When you start realizing all the symbolism and all the imagery and the way that it's structured and the way that things reflect one another, it's an amazing, amazing book. But we have to understand it correctly. So can I be a teacher for a minute instead of a preacher? Is that okay? I'm going to put a teacher hat on. So if you're bored with the next 5 minutes, then just tune back in, okay? So the person next to you can kind of elbow you and wake you back up. But I need to teach us a little bit about what Revelation really is, because we have to understand the genre of the book of Revelation. Here's why that's important. If I handed you a piece of paper and you believe that you know, it's on newsprint, this big, you know, newspaper looking piece of paper, and so you assume that it's something having to do with the news, and you read it and the first line says, "Once upon a time, there lived a magical princess with golden hair who needed to find her husband and couldn't find someone. So one day she came across a frog, and the frog told her that he was in fact a prince. She kisses the frog, he becomes a charming prince, and they live happily ever after." If you read that, but you're thinking in your head the genre of newspaper, then your head explodes, right? And you go, wait a minute. Is this really happening? Like, this is happening in the world? There's people out there that are actually frogs. If you're single, then you might think, well, maybe this is good news. Maybe there's something I can do here. So if we get our genres confused, then we can read a piece of paper as a newspaper genre, when in reality, it's a fairy tale. And wires get crossed and we do bad things. We end up taking things to places that they never should have been. The book of Revelation is in a specific genre, and that genre is called an apocalypse. Okay, an apocalypse. You probably have heard a lot about apocalypse lately, but what we've heard about is the Hunger Games and the Walking Dead and all these things that we see on TV. Apocalypse wasn't invented by J.J. Abrams. Apocalypse was something that was invented centuries ago. It was a form of literature, just like historical fiction, just like anything that you'd see at Barnes & Noble, a category. It was a very specific and distinct genre of literature, and it had rules. It has ways that you're supposed to read it. The symbolism all has specific meanings, but the purpose of the apocalyptic genre is to do two things. It's to reveal something that's hidden and to encourage people today. That's all that apocalyptic literature is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to reveal something that's hidden from our sight, and it's supposed to encourage people who are living today. And so although this was originally written to seven churches in Asia Minor in Turkey, what we call modern day Turkey, it's actually meant to be read aloud in churches. And so for centuries, it's been passed down, and we've been reading this book out loud in churches. And so we have to today read it through that same lens with that same genre in mind, knowing that the purpose is to determine what's hidden and what is the encouragement that we're supposed to find today. And so the two big questions that Revelation helps us answer are, who's really in charge and where are we headed? Who's really in charge? And where are we headed? If you read the book of Revelation and you ask those two questions of it, you will learn so much. It's such a powerful book. If we focus on the genre and we remember what we're supposed to read, which is who's really in charge and where are we headed? And so this book applies to us powerfully today. The image that Andrew read for us is this incredible snapshot of John being taken up into heaven. Okay, so we see this picture of the throne room of heaven. And there's tons of imagery. We didn't read this, but there's a rainbow that wraps around the throne. And so that rainbow represents God's covenant with Noah when God puts a rainbow in the sky and says, "I'm not going to destroy the earth." So there's this rainbow image. There's seven lamps, and it says that there's seven horns on the Lamb, and that represents the Holy Spirit. It doesn't mean that there's seven different Holy Spirits. Within the apocalyptic genre, whenever the number seven was used, it was the number of completion or the number of perfection. So it's this perfect, complete Holy Spirit that's been released into the world. There's four living creatures that are really crazy and hard to understand. But the number four is the number of the earth. Think the four corners of the earth. So the number four is the number of the earth. So it's every living creature on the earth is worshiping in front of the Lamb. And then comes this song that rises up to the Lamb when he comes to take the scroll. And so here's what we read. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals because you were slain and with your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation. Time out. That means us. Every single language, every tribe, every nation, that includes us, these heathen people that weren't Jewish people that are all the way on the other side of the world. And sidebar, has nothing to do with what we're talking about today. But if in our hearts we have leanings towards racism or xenophobia, we are not going to enjoy God's glorious future. You understand that? So if our hearts lean towards fear of people who don't look and think like us, then we're going to have a rude awakening when we enter into God's glorious future. Okay, time back in. So people of every race and tribe and nation are gathered around the throne. And this is what they say. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. A kingdom and priests. These two words that kind of fly over our heads and we think, oh, that's interesting. That's kind of interesting imagery. It's really, really important. It reaches all the way back to the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1, where God says, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule kingdom over the fish in the sea and the birds of the sky, over the livestock and all the animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So in the very beginning, God's intention and purpose for us is that we rule, that we are representatives of his good kingdom and his good order in the world. And if you think about this, the people that were reading this were living under the rule of Caesar. And they've probably never seen Caesar in their lives. They never would see Caesar. There's no way he's ever going to come to their town. But they know people who are carrying out his rule in their town. They know governors and leaders and authorities that are standing in representation of Caesar and imposing his order on their daily lives. That's the image that we see of God calling us and making us to rule and to bring his kingdom to life in this world. Then in Exodus, God talks to Moses at Mount Sinai and he says, now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. See that? A kingdom of priests. And then later in the New Testament, in 1 Peter 2:9, Peter writes that you are a royal priesthood. He's talking to the church. You, the church, are a royal priesthood. Now, what in the world does that mean? How does it have anything to do with work? It has everything to do with work, and it changes the way that we should view our daily work. We are called to be a kingdom and priests. That's the vision of God's, of our past. That's the vision of our present. That's the vision that we see of God's glorious future, and it should transform the way that we view our work. N.T. Wright, I think, sums this up best. And he says that when we think about being a kingdom of priests, we should think of being angled mirrors. You ever played with mirrors as a kid? Like shining sunlight and burning stuff, whatever. So angled mirrors, that's what we are. And so when we think of ourselves as a kingdom, as angled mirrors, we are reflecting God's good order and his loving rule into the world in which we live. So we're an angle that's tilted just right so that God's order and God's design and God's justice and mercy and peace bounces off of us and reflects out into the work that we're called to do, into the work that we are given every single day of our lives. Now, that can happen in a garden. If you're a gardener, if you're a farmer, can be easy to see. You're called to create order in the midst of chaos. You're called to bring life out of things that are dead. You're called to put things back the way that God created them to be. But it can also happen on a tax return, okay? So if you're a CPA, then God bless you right now because I know you're stressed out like crazy. But ordering a tax return and putting things in the correct order, even though they make no logical sense to human beings, putting things in God's good order and imposing his loving rule on whatever it is that your hands come into contact with in your work, you are reflecting God's good order into your world. You can be writing a memo. You can be shingling a roof. You could be wrangling kids and trying to teach them in a certain way. You can be a teacher. You can be a professor. You can work in government. Wherever you work, whatever you do, there is a way for you to reflect God's loving rule, his peace, his justice, his love, and his joy into the details of what you do on a day-to-day basis. So we're called to be a kingdom and to reflect God into our work, but we're also called to be a priesthood. And to be a priesthood means that we reflect the praises of the world back to God. This is that angled mirror again. That when the world looks at us, they don't see us, they see who we've come from. They see the one that we're following, and everything that we do is reflected back to God in worship. I don't know if you view this way, but everything you come into contact with is worshiping something. Every person, every item. When you go to the mall, it's not a neutral place at the mall, as James Smith always says. The mall is trying to influence you in a direction. Everything you, every tax return is moving in a direction. Every person, every client, every sales call is moving in a direction. And if we can find a way through our work to reflect praise back to God, then we're bringing things back to the alignment that he wants for this world. In 1 Corinthians 10, 31, Paul says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. All of it. That's the idea of what we're talking about here. That every single thing you do in that 8+ hours a day, in that 40+ hours a week, you should be doing that to the glory of God. How do we do that? We do it with an attitude of worship. In Colossians, Paul says, slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything. Now, you may think that your boss is a master and that you feel like a slave, but this actually relates to us very well in today's working culture. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when their eye is on you and to curry their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, do it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters. When we do this, when we get this picture of God's future, of us being a kingdom of priests, and we bring that to life in the present, and we begin to view ourselves as these angled mirrors that reflect God's order into the world, and we do it in a way that worships God. We do it wholeheartedly. We do good work, and we don't do it for the praise of people. We do it because God is our master. Then at the end of the day, it brings deep meaning to whatever it is that we do. So I don't know if you've ever thought of this before. You may look at me and be like, well, that's good for you to say because you're a priest. And so that's, you know, you kind of work in the church. That's what you do. But whatever it is that you do, it brings deep meaning to your work. If you're a stay-at-home mom and you're changing diapers all day and wrangling kids and keeping them from jumping off of furniture and busting their head open, it is the hardest job on the planet. It should bring deep meaning to your work. Whether you talk about Jesus tomorrow or not, it should bring deep meaning to your work because you're bringing order to a chaotic world. You're lovingly caring for God's good children. And if you do it with this attitude of a priest, then you're reflecting that work back to God in praise and giving thanks for the blessings that he's given you. Do you see that? How can that impact your world? How can that impact your work? There's so much more that we could talk about in this passage. In fact, the next phrase that we see in this song is that they will reign on the earth, talking about us. They will reign on the earth. Well, that sounds awesome. Sign me up for that. I want to reign on the earth. I want to be in power. Well, next week, we're going to talk about what does it mean to win in God's kingdom? When we look at the book of Revelation, what does it actually mean to win? And how does that influence our lives today? But for today, I want us to stop here and just think about what's going to happen tomorrow morning or later today when we engage in our world of work. When we look through the lens of God's glorious future, all work is deeply meaningful. All of it. Whatever you do, you don't have to quit your job and go start a nonprofit. Whatever you do is deeply meaningful in the kingdom of God. And so I want us to ask two questions today and think about these. What if instead of getting caught up in our goals and our agenda and our calendars and all the stress of the next 2 weeks, which I can sense for myself, I know I can see my calendar in my head for the next 2 weeks and I'm already sensing the anxiety rushing into my bloodstream. What if instead of focusing on those things, what if we focused on two questions this week as we head out these doors and go to work? Where can I bring order to God's good world? Where can I bring order to God's good world? And how can I reflect my work back to God in praise? Whatever you do, it doesn't matter. Whatever you do, there is a way for you to bring order and God's loving rule to his good world. And there is a way for you to reflect your work back to God in praise. Let's pause for a moment and pray and ask God to show us where he'd like for us to do that.